From CAFE, welcome to CAFE Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
Hi, Ann.
Hey, Preet.
Another week, another convention concluded.
Yes. I'm relieved there's no more. It's too long weeks.
Although, you know, in some ways, they were both an easier watch because it was just a couple hours at night. Did you feel compelled? Did you watch all the nights? I did.
I didn't watch all of every night, but I tried to watch both the DNC and the RNC conventions and sort of understand what's happening.
Did you watch President Trump's 73-hour speech?
I watched a lot of it. I can't say I watched
then
every
you took
minute.
A nap
did
you
watch all of
run.
It? Yeah.
And then you ate came breakfast. Back. Then you ate breakfast. Yeah. took another nap.
Did you watch it all?
I did. I kind of fell in and out of consciousness, though.
The CNN commentator who's a Republican who was like, it could have used some editing. The speech could have used some editing, which was like the understatement of the year. Yeah.
Yeah. No, as I think we discussed last week, my ears were still ringing on Thursday from being yelled at by Kimberly Guilfoyle.
Yes. You know, what was really remarkable to me is I kept sort of watching it, the convention, and seeing it was a lot of the president's family members and obviously some loyalists. And I kept thinking, like, it really was a different convention in many ways than you would expect to see. I mean, it wasn't about the up-and-coming party leaders. It wasn't about the sort of party. It was about the president. And it was different in that way, I think, from the Democratic convention, but also from prior Republican conventions in a really extreme way, at least. Like, I was sort of watching it thinking, this feels weird to me, and it felt odd.
Well, one reason it felt odd, and maybe this can be our first topic to discuss today, is that on Thursday night, the event took place on the South Lawn of the White House, which has never happened before. And one of the reasons it's never happened before is people consider the White House to be the People's House. It's a federal building. And both norms and a statute called the Hatch Act generally, and we can get into the details of it in a minute, but they generally prohibit political activity, campaign activity, which this was, in certain places that taxpayers fund. So, you know, before we get to the issue of whether or not there was a violation of the Hatch Act and the details of that, just generally, like, the look of a campaign event, a pure political event happening at the White House, how was your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was really troubled by it. And I think you said it well by talking about the People's House, the White House. And it's a very interesting thing. The president is the commander-in-chief, is the president of the United States, and also at the same time is running for re-election. So the president naturally combines politics and government in a way that nobody else in government is supposed to. But there's always been that line, and the political convention has always been about the pure politics of re-election. And to see that on the government lawn, it was jarring for me. And I think it also is just yet another example in my mind of how, like, the president doesn't care about norms. He doesn't care about laws. And in particular, he puts himself and right now his reelection above everything else. And so I mean, it's weird, right? And even if it's not illegal, we'll talk about that.
I think it's even worse than not caring and being apathetic about the law. I think he actually revels in it. There are some reports that he actually loves the idea that it makes people angry and it triggers people, and that there's nothing anybody can do about it. Because he's discovered, someone else wrote, I can't remember who it was, you know, the president took some time to discover just how much of government, especially in the executive branch at his level, relies upon the honor system, and how much he can do whatever he wants, and there's no one to stop him. So it's not just that he doesn't care. He, I think, cares in the other direction. If it's something that he can do that nobody's done before, and it fits with his vision of what looks good, and it creates a good tableau, and as a bonus,
yeah, I think it's his brand.
It pisses people off. Yeah, that's what he does.
I do think you're right. I think it's his brand in the sense also of, you know, he ran, going back to 2016, as an outsider, I'm going to drain the swamp. We'll talk about that. That's obviously not true. But this idea of, I don't follow, I'm not going to be held in by the government bureaucracy, and I don't have to follow these rules. Like, there is, like, this huge branding thing with his supporters who have remained, many of whom have remained loyal to him, which is this, you know, he's different, and we like that about him. And so he leans into the, yeah, I don't follow your silly rules. I don't have to follow your rules. I'm the president, and I'm going to do things my way. And so I think you're right in saying that he he relishes in it.
And it's not just, by the way, the fact that his main speech was on the White House lawn. There was also Mike Pompeo, first Secretary of State. I don't know if it's ever, or at least in modern times, to speak at a convention. From
the Pompeo thing Jerusalem. Was just beyond.
I'm Mike Pompeo. I'm speaking to you from beautiful Jerusalem, looking out over the old city.
And then something that I think is equally crazy was the naturalization ceremony at the White House.
Can we talk about that? Those people.
Two of them didn't know they were going to be featured in the convention. I think one of the campaign people said, oh, yeah, we didn't know. I forget who it was who said, we didn't know it was going to be featured in the convention. You know, we just had like 9 cameras set up and lighting, and it was done close in time to the convention.
I laugh because it's absurd. It's absurd. No, please. Like, it was all staged for the convention. And they did, like, the minimum they had to do to try to have, like, a disguise of it being legitimate. And just, maybe we should break this down a little bit. But they set it up to do the naturalization ceremony and with the president and the acting DHS secretary, Chad Wolf. And they had all these cameras there. And they literally didn't put it on the president's public schedule.
It was Wolf who said he didn't know it was going to be used for the convention.
Right. Meanwhile, it was Wolf who said that. Yeah. Yes. And I mean, they then put it on YouTube for a hot second just so that they have the ability to say, we're taking this public, like we're taking publicly available material. So you don't get around things like the Hatch Act by basically doing a political act for the convention and just sort of trying to whitewash it by putting it up on YouTube for 5 minutes before.
So we should address what the Hatch Act does and does not say. And to be clear, the Hatch Act explicitly exempts the president of the United States and the vice president of the United States for various reasons, because going back to what you said before, it's sort of difficult in the wisdom of Congress to apply those things and that separation to somebody who is both the leader of a political party and also the leader of the country. But everyone else has to obey and abide by the Hatch Act. And it says a lot of different things, among them that political activities are prohibited. Specifically, quote, an employee may not engage in political activity while the employee is on duty in any room or building occupied in the discharge of official duties by an individual employed or holding office in the government of the United States or any agency or instrumentality thereof. And it goes on to talk about not doing political activity when wearing a uniform, not using your official authority or influence for the purpose of interfering with or affecting the result of an election. And you and I have both had experiences where we've had to abide by the Hatch Act. We were talking about this last week in passing. You know, maybe we should give an example to folks of how seriously people in Congress and staff in Congress heed the Hatch Act on a daily basis, only to watch it flouted by this president.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, it's one of the first things you are told when you start at the Department of Justice is basically, here's what you can't do. And you can't, here's an example, like let's say you wanted to go out and canvass for a presidential candidate, you individually could go out and do that. You just couldn't say, I'm Preet Bharara, I work for the United States government. You could say, hi, my name is Preet Bharara, I'm supporting X for president, I'd like you to support them too. But you can't in any way connect the political activity to your government office. And it's important to note that the goal of the Hatch Act, and this is from the Office of Special Counsel at DOJ, basically says, like, you know, the purpose is to ensure that federal programs are administered in a nonpartisan fashion to protect federal employees from political coercion in the workplace, and to make sure federal employees advance based on merit and not political affiliation. So the goal really is to, like, as you say, separate it out. It's also, you can't stop someone from being politically active, right? That's a right that we all have. But you can basically say to them, you can't in any way be political at work. And there's a lot about, you talked about it last week of, you know, when you worked for Senator Schumer, like if anything had to do with the campaign, you would not physically be in your office, your Senate office.
Staffers had to, you have to leave the building. You have to leave the building that the public pays for, whether it's the Senate Hart building or Russell building or whatever, or House building. And you go to a privately paid for office or office space or the sidewalk. So you can do anything political like campaign fundraising or anything else. And the same true for you when you worked for your senator.
Right. And I think we even talked about this. I don't remember if we did it when we were recording or when we were just chatting during the week, but members of Congress, the political parties rent offices near their office building so they can go and make fundraising calls from them. Like they take this so seriously, Democrat and Republican, like they wouldn't make those calls from their office. So it is a longstanding tradition. It is a really important tradition. And the idea is to insulate the work of government from politics. And it's really important. And so one of the things that I think is interesting, and I wanted to ask you about this a little too, is that, you know, you can't be, so you have to be in your personal capacity, not in your professional capacity. So all those White House employees, all those government employees who were at the White House during the president's speech, like they had to be there in their quote personal capacity, not in their work capacity. They're also not allowed to be in an official government building. So the president, you know, if he'd given that speech at DOJ, they couldn't be there doing politics. But what's interesting is like the law is pretty, it's interesting because it talks about being like inside official government buildings, but the Rose Garden is not, you know, the White House lawn is not inside an official government building. And so
well, the special counsel takes the position, and it's a kind of a, it's a little bit of a Weasley document that the special counsel put out saying that concerns could be raised if there are these circumstances, not raised if there are these other circumstances. And I don't know if this is a position taken before, maybe it's never had to be taken before. But the special counsel in this administration, in the current one, as you said, takes the position that the South Lawn and the Rose Garden are exempt from the Hatch Act prohibitions because it's not federal.
Which
government.
I don't
know if that's true.
I don't fully agree with it, but I think the way the law is written gave them the opportunity to make that argument. I mean, it feels to me, you know, those spaces of the White House are used as government spaces. And so it feels to me a stretch. But, you know, again, it's a very interesting question of sort of nobody's pushed the Hatch Act, like the literal language of the Hatch Act in this way before. And right. So you end up in
it's
the position
cute by
of the
half.
President's. Yeah.
It's too cute by half. It's not that different from the immigration naturalization ceremony. It's like, let's figure out a hyper-technical, face-saving way to say, no, we were doing this for just regular purposes, official purposes. We put it on YouTube for a hot minute, as you said, and then we're going to just use that footage like we would any other kind of footage for campaign and political purposes. It's the same kind of thing with the South Lawn and the Rose Garden.
Yeah, I agree. So one of the questions a lot of people have asked me in the past week is what's the penalty for a violation of the Hatch Act? So again, not the president and vice president, but Chad Wolf, the employees of DHS, you know, all those folks. And one of the things that I was really interested to see is that the Office of Special Counsel, DOJ, can investigate the allegations of Hatch Act violations. And NPR reported this past week that it's often up to the employee's supervisor to act on the advice of the Office of Special Counsel. But one of the things I found really interesting is that the federal agency that's supposed to actually adjudicate violations, so if somebody violates it, it goes to the Merit Systems Protection Board. And that board usually has three members. Did you see how many members it has right now, Preet?
I believe that's the null set, zero.
Exactly. So there are
I'll take what is zero.
You could almost always guess that in this administration that like, you know, like how many people are actually on that board? Zero. And so again, you start to think of this way in which it's like a web of ways in which Trump and the administration are undercutting the rule of law and the norms. But that's like a great example of, okay, somebody violates it, file a complaint with the Merit Systems Protection Board. And then what happens when there's nobody on that board?
Can I stop you for a second? And as I like to do from time to time, comment on your language, which I enjoy very much. You used a new phrase just now, and I kind of like it because it has alliteration. A web of ways. A web of ways, you said. They have a web of ways.
Oh, they do. Yeah. A web of ways that they're doing this. Yep.
Right. It's kind of a twist on a web of lies. A web of ways.
Yeah.
And as you point out, there can be an investigation. There can be a clear violation. There can be a recommendation of punishment, which has been made a number of times with respect to the now departed Kellyanne Conway. But if the supervisor is the president and the president doesn't give a damn and doesn't care, then you can do these things with impunity.
Right. And should we talk about what the, so there are both civil and criminal laws that prohibit violating the Hatch Act. A lot of this is done civilly. So somebody who violates the Hatch Act, so the penalties under the Hatch Act, if you violate it, are an employee or individual who violates it shall be subject to one disciplinary action consisting of removal, reduction in grade, which is your level in government, debarment from federal employment for a period up to 5 years, suspension or reprimand, civil penalty not to exceed $1,000, or any combination of the above. And there's also a criminal statute that basically makes it unlawful for any person to intimidate, threaten, command, coerce, intimidate, or attempt to do those things, someone to engage or not engage in any political activity. And so the criminal statute is really not frequently used in this. It's really often about the civil violations that are brought. And people have been fined. People have been fired. I mean, there are...
There's a Washington Post article that you and I both read that gives example after example of people who get real penalties. There's an example of a Defense Logistics Agency employee suspended for 30 days after giving his office colleagues... All he did was give a PowerPoint presentation that displayed the words, "Vote Republican." That's a no-no. 30 days, no pay. An Energy Department worker forced to resign earlier this year after admitting she gave a woman running for Congress a tour of a federal waste treatment plant so the candidate could show her expertise to potential voters. And there's many examples of this. And this president doesn't seem to care when it comes to him and his campaign.
One last point is that within the White House, there have been violations of this. And the most prominent has been Kellyanne Conway, who, as we know, you know, she's given multiple speeches basically advocating for Republican candidates, disparaging Democratic politicians. And there was one particular example where she was disparaging Democratic political candidates while speaking as on TV interviews and social media. So basically, there's a finding made against her that she violates the Hatch Act. It's recommended that she be fired, right? That's the recommendation. But then it goes to, who does it go to make the decision? President Trump. And obviously, President Trump didn't do anything. And there is a line where Kellyanne Conway is asked about it. And her response is, quote, and this is from the Washington Post article you mentioned. She says, quote, "blah, blah, blah. Let me know when the jail sentence starts." So meaning she can do this with impunity. She's never going to be held accountable.
Yeah. And it goes back to the point we're making about Trump. It's not that he doesn't care. It's almost a reveling in it by Kellyanne Conway, too. The current White House chief of staff used to be a member of Congress, Mark Meadows. This is what he said.
Nobody outside of the Beltway really cares. They expect that Donald Trump is going to promote Republican values, and they would expect that Barack Obama, when he was in office, that he would do the same for Democrats. And so, listen, this is a lot of hoopla that's being made about things, mainly because the convention has been so unbelievably successful.
That's a stunning statement of the chief of staff to a president who keeps saying law and order, only when it comes to other people. And it's also stunning because I've seen footage of Mark Meadows as a member of Congress in the Obama administration, absolutely saying that the Hatch Act was important and absolutely saying it should apply to cabinet officials in the Obama administration. So there's a lot of hypocrisy. There's a lot of double standards going on here. And look, is it a matter of life and death in the country? No. But it's a steady and continuing erosion of things that were established for a reason and that, by the way, are supposed to apply to both parties. And, you know, it's just going to make it easier for people of the other party when they come into power, if they also don't have ethics, to engage in this kind of violation and this kind of unethical conduct. And it won't be right then either.
I agree. And we should note that Democratic administrations have also had violations of it. One of the Obama cabinet members who ran Health and Human Services made a political comment at a speech and was held accountable under the Hatch Act for it. So it's not like this never happens because, again, sometimes people wear
multiple
hats.
But those are minor things compared to the series of things that happened last week.
What it appears to be sort of not strategic, intentional, repeated violations of the law knowingly and intentionally, right? Like this idea that there was a lot of condemnation about the president doing this at the White House before the Republican National Convention. A lot of people raised issues about it. And to your point, they embraced that and they did it. And so I think that's very different than somebody giving a speech, making a comment they shouldn't have made, being held accountable. This is intentionally deciding to violate the law and understanding that, you know, that their intention is not to hold people accountable. And look, somebody could make a complaint against a DHS employee who was there and say they were ordered to be there, they weren't there in their personal capacity, they were engaged in political conduct. And again, it's going to go either to their supervisor, who is going to have been likely instructed not to hold them accountable, Merit Systems Board, where there are no counselors. So it sort of all leads back to the same road of the president will get away with it, the administration will get away with it, but we shouldn't accept that as something that's okay to do.
So the other big news, more recent even, yesterday, August 31st, the continuing saga, I think we call it a saga, right? In the case of Michael Flynn, the United States versus Michael Flynn, which goes back and forth and up and down and in a web of ways, as a friend of mine recently said. The latest, when we last left this saga, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, sitting in its entirety, was considering the question of whether or not they could compel the district court judge to drop the case, to accept the motion to dismiss, or whether or not they should let the district court judge go about his business and conduct an inquiry as to why all of a sudden the Department of Justice was suddenly asking for the case to be dismissed. So it's a sort of a narrow legal question against a backdrop of a lot of politics and a lot of legal wrangling, but a narrow question of whether or not the court at the appellate level can, before there's a decision by the lower court, force a decision favorable to the defendant. And in the initial outing, there's a 3-judge panel. Two judges, Judge Henderson and Judge Rao, voted in favor of compelling the judge to drop the case, saying you don't really have any business in conducting a big inquiry of any kind. Then it went to the whole court. 10 of the 11 judges sat. And what was the result?
Yes. So by 8-2, they overruled the original D.C. Circuit decision. And they basically found that Judge Sullivan could go ahead with the hearing, that he could have the help of amicus, and particularly former Judge John Gleason, who he'd appointed to do an evaluation of whether or not Flynn had perjured himself, and that Judge Sullivan wasn't biased, and that he didn't have to recuse from the matter, that he could sit on the matter. And so it's wholesale.
And not disqualified. Yeah, no reassignment and no disqualification. So basically they lost on all counts.
Wholesale. Yes, it was like a complete undoing. And I think you and I talked about this a lot, but the rules around mandamus is, as we know, it's an extraordinary writ, and it doesn't happen except in the most extreme situations. And so this is, and I think both of our view, consistent with what the law is and where it should have been, and the original D.C. Circuit Court opinion was wrong. What is really interesting to see is that there's also this little subtext here of of course, the two judges, Henderson and Rao, they dissent. And so they're the two who go against the D.C. Circuit en banc ruling. They basically are making this whole argument against Judge Sullivan, who's the district court judge, saying he shouldn't be, you know, he's biased because he's appealing this ruling. Like it's all very, very interesting. And the majority opinion comes back and says, actually, we took this because a judge raised it sua sponte on their own. One of the judges of the D.C. Circuit wanted to hear this. So you and I talked a lot about this up front, that any single judge could say, we want to hear this. But this does, the fact that a judge did ask for it, in addition to Judge Sullivan asking the court to hear it, says to me that the D.C. Circuit thought that as an institutional matter, it was really important to address what the court did here. And so the administration is getting called out and will be held to account through this hearing. But again, you know, that's just the right thing that's supposed to happen under the law. And so it's an important day and a big win, I think, for the rule of law. But we should all understand that, you know, this is what should have happened in the first place, in my view.
Yeah. And look, and it comes on the heels of another en banc, you know, full court ruling that overwhelmingly favored the other side. I think it's worth just quoting briefly from a concurring opinion filed by one of the D.C. Circuit Court judges, Judge Griffith, who says, and this is an important point for everyone, right? Because everything gets steeped in politics, and President Trump talks about Democrat judges and Republican judges, and Griffith tries to cut through that by making the following point. Quote, in cases that attract public attention, it is common for pundits and politicians to frame their commentary in a way that reduces the judicial process to little more than a skirmish in a partisan battle. The party affiliation of the president who appoints a judge becomes an explanation for the judge's real reason for the disposition, and the legal reasoning employed is seen as a cover for the exercise of raw political power. And then he says, quote, this proceeding is not about the merits of the prosecution of General Flynn or the government's decision to abandon that prosecution. Rather, this proceeding involves questions about the structure of the judiciary and its relationship to the executive branch. And he goes on to talk about the narrow question of whether or not, as we said, a circuit court can basically direct a ruling when the decision is still pending. And at the end of the day, part of the reasoning of the majority is that, look, the defendant who made the motion still has a chance to win. And as you and I have been discussing from the beginning, probably will. The case probably will be dismissed because the Justice Department does have the main role in deciding whether to pursue or not pursue a criminal prosecution. All that Judge Sullivan is trying to do is get a little bit more explanation, which he's allowed in his discretion, as the overwhelming majority of the court also agreed with.
I think your point on Judge Griffith is really important. Also, he's retiring from the D.C. Circuit. He's a George W. Bush appointee. And he felt strongly enough about this not to just join the majority, but to separately write this concurrence. And I think that's important because he's basically arguing, you know, look, there's no basis for a mandamus here. And he's trying to cut through some of the noise about, you know, this isn't a partisan thing. This is basically how the law works. And I think that's also important because he, of course, sat, and it's been pointed out by a number of commentators, he sat on the D.C. Circuit with Kavanaugh. He's worked with Roberts. Like, he has very close relationships with a lot of the Supreme Court justices. He's well-regarded as a jurist. And so this may be appealed to the Supreme Court. And I think what he was trying to do is send a really powerful and strong message of, like, look, this is, like, we shouldn't even be having this conversation in many ways, and we have to sort of reset where we are. So what do you think happens next, Preet? Do you think it gets appealed?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Flynn folks will appeal it. But, you know, even before we get to that, we don't do a lot of sort of, I guess we do some of this, second-guessing of lawyers' tactics. I think it was a real mistake on the part of Flynn's lawyers to go for the mandamus. Things were essentially going their way. There may have had to be some, and now there will be, an uncomfortable hearing for the Justice Department. But I don't know why they got sidetracked, given the weight of the law against a mandamus in this kind of situation. And all they've done is succeed in, I guess, dragging it out, you know, far beyond the point where it would have been. But what will happen next? I don't know. I think the law is overwhelming that mandamus should not issue, that Judge Sullivan should be able to have his hearing and then make his decision. It's as simple as that. But as Andy McCarthy of the National Review said the other day, quote, Flynn will eventually prevail in having the case dismissed because he has an ace in the hole. If all else fails, the president will pardon him, end quote. And that kind of, I think, is correct.
Yeah, I think so, too. And I guess to your point about legally, there's no question legally it was a mistake to do mandamus, I think. But I guess the question I would ask you is, like, is there a political advantage that they see in some ways dragging this out? It feels strange to me as well. I don't think so.
The party that's going to be put in the hot seat is not so much Flynn as the Department of Justice, right? The hearing that the government—
Completely,
the hearing
yes.
that the judge wants to have is, why of all the cases in all the world is this the one where the government said, despite two guilty pleas, we want to make it go away? Like, what is so different? What happened? Who interfered? Why does Bill Barr care so much? It doesn't matter from the perspective of Michael Flynn, except insofar as if the judge found that there was something nefarious going on, I guess he could deny the motion. I just don't think there's going to be a denial of the motion, although you never know.
I don't think there's going to be a denial of the motion either. I think ultimately Judge Sullivan is going to dismiss it, but I think he's going to make them, well, we don't know what's going to come out at the hearing, so obviously that could change, but I think he's going to make DOJ do exactly what you said, which is to explain why they're doing this and to be forced onto the record and to be held to account. Even if he ultimately goes with them, he's going to make them articulate it and explain it, and he's going to take his pound of flesh on forcing them to not be able to just whitewash it. And so I think that's what he was going for, my gut. I mean, we don't know. We haven't obviously have no insight into this, but it feels to me like he wants them to have to explain what they're doing, not to just be able to walk all over the rule of law with no accountability. And so he'll get that. And then the ultimate decision, I think you're right, that it's more likely than not that he'll favor Flynn and dismiss it. And I agree also with the conservative commentator, McCarthy, that, look, at the end of the day, the president could just pardon him, and the president probably will just pardon him if it doesn't go the way that Flynn and his team want.
So we should also talk about continuing developments in Wisconsin upon the shooting of Jacob Blake. And then there's been protests in Kenosha and other places. And there's a young individual named Kyle Rittenhouse who shot and killed two protesters, wounded another. There was a lot of controversy about that. And of course, the president decides to get involved in some ways with respect to this controversy and not involved in other aspects of this controversy. So should we talk about the case regarding Jacob Blake first?
Yeah, let's start with Blake. Our understanding, and we talked about this a little bit, is that Blake has been paralyzed, and one of the officers has now been named, Rustin Chesky, the officer who shot Blake 7 times in the back while holding onto Blake's shirt. And there's also been some reporting that Blake had a knife in his possession or in his car. It sounds more likely that's been reported by the Wisconsin Department of Justice. And all the officers have been placed on administrative leave. One of the other officers had used a taser on Blake. Chesky had used a taser on Blake and also shot him 7 times from close range, as you can see in the video. And there was a female officer at the scene who, it appears, did not use any force. And so I think there are a couple of points to be made. And there's a lot that we don't know about this. And I want to just sort of stress that, because there's been a lot of information. The unions have made statements. The police chief has made statements. And what we don't have is a clear picture of what happened that day. It looks like there was a 911 call to the scene for a woman who was reporting that her ex-boyfriend had arrived. It's not clear to me, and I just want to sort of say this to folks, it's not clear to me what, if any, basis the police had to stop Blake. And I think that that's an important point just to make, which is that if the police do not have a reasonable suspicion, you know, they can always ask you questions. A police officer can always come up to you and say, hey, what's your name? What are you doing? And you can answer or not answer. But as a rule, if there's no basis for that stop, the police can try to get you to say something, but they have to let you walk away. And so the reason this is important also is that, you know, and not justifying what happens later in any way, but just understanding, and it's important to ask these questions, like, was the attempt to detain Blake even lawful at the first point, right? Was that under the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution that prohibits unreasonable search and seizure? Like, this is a legitimate question of, like, why are they even there? What are they doing? What are they entitled to do? Were they even entitled to put hands on him to stop him? And then we get to the second point, which is, you know, you have someone being shot in the back with no obvious weapon. And so that had been followed essentially by officers for some distance. And so there are going to be a lot of questions about the use of force by those officers. And, you know, my sort of view always is when you have somebody who's shot in the back, you need to be asking a lot of questions about that as a rule. And officers, you know, this is going to be a complicated sort of situation because we don't have enough information, but at some point it's going to become clear. We're going to know a lot more. And we do need to know a lot more. But I think people should understand that there's just this basic principle, which is that when an officer says that they needed to fire, the use of force becomes justified. It is often because they will articulate that they believe someone had a weapon and was about to kill them. So the use of deadly force is often only allowed in response to a belief of a threat of deadly force. It is really hard to make that argument when somebody is not facing you, when there's no weapon in someone's hand. And so, you know, and it's just worth noting that a lot of concerns that people are raising relate to the fact of, you know, they chosen to tase him, which meant they chose less lethal force to begin with, meaning that the officers didn't think that there was a threat to their safety. So then it looks like the officer shot him because he couldn't stop him and he wasn't complying with a lawful order. You don't get to do that. So if an officer is telling somebody to stop and they're running away, you can't shoot someone to stop them from running away. That's not a reasonable use of force. And so again, we'll come back and have longer conversations as this goes forward about, you know, if there are charges brought, what those charges are against the officers. Blake, it appears, had an open warrant for a sex assault allegation. And so a lot will come down to, you know, why the officers were there, what level of force they could have used. It changes over time as situations evolve, but this is what people are going to look at. And, you know, again, my very quick read from looking at it is that it's a problematic shooting and should not have happened. But again, we'll sort of follow it.
Yeah, look, I agree. I think your analysis is very good here. But the other point I would make is, you know, there's a larger question of how policing should be conducted. And people like you and me and others, and people who are in a decision-making capacity, after an event happens, go through rigorously what the law is and make arguments about whether or not a police officer in a problematic shooting can be charged and what they can be charged with and should they be. And that's an important question for accountability. But it's not the only question. The other question is, you know, whether we should be, you know, talking about police being able to exert their discretion up to the edge of legality and what arguments you can make in favor of that or against that, I think it's plain to see that in case after case after case, there should be policies, regardless of what you could argue ultimately at the end of the day in a court of law if there's a bad shooting, but policies that make certain kinds of conduct by the police just wrong. You know, there are these questions of whether or not, as a legal matter, you can make the argument that if he was going for a knife, they could shoot him. But the more important question in some ways, as a matter of policy throughout the country and in police departments around America, is what officers should be doing, whether or not you can later make some argument legally or otherwise. What should they be doing when you have an unarmed person who is many feet away from a car, about whom you, it's not clear you have full, no, not probable cause, but not even maybe reasonable suspicion? What is the thing you do to prevent a bad result like this? And that's the fundamental question that police departments should be asking.
I think that's the right question. And I think it's the right question also because if you think about, you know, the Camden use of force policy, which requires de-escalation, then the first question you're asking is, how do we step back from conflict? How do we avoid getting into a shooting? So the question then becomes like, how do we avoid even putting ourselves in a situation where the end result can be a bad one? And that completely changes the way officers think about whether they approach him in the car. People have asked me like, well, what else could they have done? Look, they could have let him get in the car and had another car try to stop him when they had a bigger team of supports. Like there's 20 things they could have done to try to avoid the situation getting here. And I think, you know, you're right. What I was just doing, because a lot of folks have sort of asked for the and we've gotten questions from listeners about this, like what's the legal analysis of the shooting in that moment? And that's what I'm sort of going through is like what's required. But I think you're asking the right question, which is, why are we even getting to the point? And how do we change policies and structure so we don't get there? Because we've seen this many times that if you get to this point where something happens, officers react in a certain way. And I think the question is, how do you avoid getting into that situation in the first place? And so you're asking exactly the right question. And the other piece I'd say is that for a long time, we've talked about shootings, police department shootings, and I think this has to change as many of them being lawful but awful, meaning under the law, a judge or jury will find that based on the law that an officer, you know, at that moment in time, it was reasonable for them to have used their weapon, but all of us can agree it should never have gotten to the point where that happened. There was no reason that someone had to be killed.
One more point on this. Unlike in some other cases, it has been reported that the Department of Justice has opened a federal civil rights investigation into the shooting of Jacob Blake. And, you know, you and I have been critical of the department, whether or not it brings pattern and practice investigations to various police departments in the wake of things happening over the last months and years. But in this case, they did open one up. Do you think that means that there's a change of policy or direction at the department, or is it a one-off?
Yeah, it's not clear to me why they would open this and not the investigation in George Floyd specifically. So I have a lot of questions as to why this department investigation was opened. That's my old section at DOJ. As a matter of course, usually there'd be an investigation opened into all of these shootings, all of these police shootings. And so I think it's the right thing for DOJ to do it. They may also have been asked, again, we don't know this, but they may have been asked by the locals to do so, to open up an investigation. But it is important. And it's worth just sort of noting that there's value in DOJ often doing these things because there's local politics. It's difficult with local police officers. And so there's value in having the federal investigation. Although we've talked about this, the standard is quite high. Willful violation under color of law. So a police officer willfully violating someone's constitutional rights, here it would be the Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure. And so, you know, I think one of the national conversations that's happening is, should this be taking place in state or federal? Because the federal law, the standard can be high and difficult to meet. And so, but yes, DOJ is open, and I think that's an important piece of this.
So in the wake of the shooting, there have been protests, I think understandably. And then there have been people who have traveled to the protests from outside the state. One such person, as we mentioned, Kyle Rittenhouse, 17 years old, armed with a long gun in the midst of a protest. And there's some controversy about exactly what transpired. There's some video that has been shown, and people are drawing, in some cases, dramatically different conclusions from the video. essentially, what we know for sure is that Kyle Rittenhouse shot three people, killed two. And before we get into what we think of the conduct and whether it was lawful or not, the local prosecutor has immediately charged Rittenhouse with a series of significant crimes. Six counts. First-degree reckless homicide. Two counts of first-degree recklessly endangering safety. First-degree intentional homicide. Attempted first-degree intentional homicide. And possession of a dangerous weapon by a person under 18. So quick charges, serious charges, among the most serious you can bring. And yet, there are people, up to and including the President of the United States, and people like Tucker Carlson, who are not only decrying the charges, but basically saying things like,
"We do know why it all happened, though. Kenosha has devolved into anarchy because the authorities in charge of the city abandoned it. People in charge from the governor of Wisconsin on down refused to enforce the law. They stood back and they watched Kenosha burn. So are we really surprised that looting and arson accelerated to murder? How shocked are we that 17-year-olds with rifles decided they had to maintain order when no one else would?"
How do we have such a gulf of between the charging decision here by the local prosecutor and the things that some people are saying in his favor?
Well, I think we even have to go back a step, which is that after the shooting of Blake, there were a number of protests that, I mean, obviously nationally, we've been seeing Black Lives Matter protests, but in Kenosha, Wisconsin, there have been a series of protests just continually demanding reform to the police department, the resignation of the police chief and the sheriff. I mean, it's been largely peaceful protests. Now, one thing I think that's important to understand is that there has been like this movement by groups that are against the protesters. And so there have been right-wing groups, there have been white supremacist groups that have been posting on social media. There have been sort of defend our towns against rioting and looting posts that have been going on social media. Some of the groups are, are stated to be pro-Trump. Many of them are just right-wing extremists. And so there's been this sort of marshaling on the right of these counter forces to the demonstrators. And so Rittenhouse was there as part of, he shows up at these sort of counter demonstrations to sort of ostensibly protect property from looting. And so I think we just have to be honest about what's happening, which is that there are protests. They're largely lawful. There has been some looting and rioting, which of course, you know, everyone, we condemn that very strongly. It has no place in this. And then you have this sort of counter thing on the right that looks to be almost, you know, exploiting or taking advantage of this unrest in cities and communities that's basically putting it in a position where, so you now have the police and folks in a community trying to make sure that the protests are peaceful. You now have them dealing with the anti-protesters who are coming, many of them armed, like Rittenhouse, who are escalating conflicts. And so you have this, what I think is a really, it's just a tinderbox. And so we've now seen this happen with Rittenhouse shooting, murdering two people and having one person injured. But this has also happened in other places. In Portland, there was an individual who shot and killed who was basically wearing a hat that was affiliated with a right-wing group. And so, you know, you've done a lot of terrorism work, Preet. Like, this feels to me like there is, and I don't know whether we would classify some of this as domestic terrorism, but there's a real undercurrent here that makes me very concerned of what we're seeing play out in cities. And Rittenhouse is a part of what we're seeing play out.
Yeah, I mean, there are too many people who are seeking violence and violent confrontation. And you have politicians like the president who are basically looking like they're inciting violence and taking sides, as opposed to having everyone come out and take down the temperature and promote peaceful protest and discourage people from being armed and going to protest, whatever side you're on. I think it's exactly right what you said. There's a tinderbox situation. And at any moment, you know, a match can light the fuse and it can get even more out of hand than it is already. So look, so the facts are with respect to Rittenhouse that he shot three people, two were dead, and he's been charged. The only thing he can assert, given that there's no defense, you know, to his not being the guy, right? Like when you have a homicide case, there are two things that you can argue. It wasn't me. Or it was me, but I had the right to self-defense. And so in this case, he's only got the second thing. And the state laws about self-defense, you know, are interesting. It doesn't come up that much in federal prosecutions. But in Wisconsin, people should understand a couple of things about the law of self-defense, because the president himself, from the White House podium, has basically rendered a legal conclusion and said,
"You saw the same tape as I saw. He was trying to get away from them, I guess, it looks like, and he fell, and then they very violently attacked him. And it was something that we're looking at right now, and it's under investigation. But I guess he was in very big trouble. He would have been, he probably would have been killed, but it's under investigation."
I don't think that the president has read the Wisconsin statute, but luckily for our listeners, you and I have. And among other things, the self-defense law in Wisconsin says the actor, meaning the person who did the shooting, the defendant, the actor may intentionally use only such force or threat thereof as the actor reasonably believes is necessary to prevent or terminate the interference. And that means the interference with his or her person by another person. And then importantly, it says, the actor may not intentionally use force which is intended or likely to cause death, which would be shooting, or great bodily harm, unless the actor reasonably believes that such force is necessary to prevent imminent death or great bodily harm to himself or herself. So the question is going to be, with respect to each shooting, remember that, you know, facts evolve and circumstances change, and I don't think we have a full video of the whole incident. The question will be, did Rittenhouse reasonably believe that he was about to be on the other side of imminent death or great bodily harm? And you'll have to make an assessment. Another important point, and then I'm wondering what you think about all this, there's this legal concept of provocation. And if you're a provocateur, if you're the one who engaged in a provocation, that may render you unable to assert self-defense. And so the provocation law in Wisconsin says, quote, a person who engages in unlawful conduct of a type likely to provoke others to attack him or her, and thereby does provoke an attack, is not entitled to claim the privilege of self-defense against such attack. And then it goes on to talk about imminent danger of death and great bodily harm. Both of those concepts are at play here, and it's going to matter not just whether he thought he was under threat of imminent death or serious bodily harm, but whether or not he did something to provoke the reaction of the other protesters. So it gets a little complicated, right?
And just to add to that on provocation, it does get complicated. And if you provoke someone, then you have to, like, Rittenhouse would have had to basically, to use deadly force, would have had to have reasonably, quote, reasonably believed that he has exhausted every other reasonable means to escape from or otherwise avoid death or great bodily harm. And so it really is a situation where if you've provoked somebody, you can't shoot them because they're coming towards you. You know, it's a very high burden. Like, you have an obligation to try to escape or to basically do something short of using that level of force. And what's really important in this case, Preeta, is I think also you have to remember that there's been reporting in Wisconsin that Rittenhouse and some others brought weapons to a used car lot to try to allegedly defend that used car lot.
So people are getting injured, and our job is to protect this business, and part of my job is to also help people. If there's somebody hurt, I'm running into harm's way. That's why I have my rifle, because I can protect myself, obviously.
They are not entitled to do that under the law. That is the job of the police. And so, you know, the police are not asking them to go out and protect the neighborhoods and the used cars. So they are there basically of their own decision to go out armed. It is a carry state, not under the age of 18, but people can be armed in the state. But they're not allowed to be doing what they're doing, right? And so you sort of get to this position of, it's hard not to see that as in some ways beginning this question of, like, you know, are they provoking something even just to start by basically going out there armed and getting into arguments with people? And then, you know, there's also a video of one of the individuals who is, I believe, shot and killed by Rittenhouse throwing a plastic bag in his direction. We should be very clear, though, if it comes to self-defense, you cannot shoot someone because they've thrown any type of bag at you, right? It has to be in that moment that you fear that they are about to kill you or cause serious bodily harm to you, and you're in imminent danger. And so I think that the self-defense, I absolutely agree with you. Rittenhouse is going to argue self-defense. I agree it's going to be one by one. I think it is a very high hurdle for him to meet, and particularly on the provocation piece because he shoots someone and then he's going to argue that people were trying to basically stop him and that's why he fired the second and third shots. But if they're trying to stop him, they're trying to stop him because he's just shot someone and he's trying to leave the scene.
Yeah, I think with respect to the second, whether or not he was a provocateur is going to be important. He will also be able to argue, I think the reporting is, that at least one of the protesters that was chasing him or surrounding him also was armed with a firearm. And that will change the calculus as well. There's just one more part of the provocation law that I want to read. I'm very fascinated by Wisconsin self-defense law because this may apply in this case if you think about the mindset of the people who are the counter-protesters who traveled interstate to come to this protest. And this part of the law says, quote, and think about how this applies to Rittenhouse, quote, a person who provokes an attack, whether by lawful or unlawful conduct, with intent to use such an attack as an excuse to cause death or great bodily harm to his or her assailant, is not entitled to claim the privilege of self-defense, end quote. Now, we can discuss whether or not that has application to Rittenhouse, and we maybe don't know his state of mind. But that concept, I worry we're going to have to come back to in the future, as there are undoubtedly people who are counter-protesters and support certain views who are going to be going to places absolutely with an intent to have an excuse to impose bodily harm or death with their weapons. And we'll see what happens here. But it's an important provision in the law that takes into account people who are going to show up and pretend that they're engaging in some lawful conduct, like being substitute police officers and menacing protesters in a particular way to provoke them into having a justification to shoot. And that doesn't fly, at least not in Wisconsin.
But I agree. I think it will be litigated. Two other questions for you, Preet. One is, I mean, traditionally, federal law enforcement agencies like the FBI, they have tracked white supremacist groups. They have tracked these movements, the right-wing extremist movements, the armed militias. I assume, I mean, there are a lot of postings on social media. I assume that they are tracking them. And I think, you know, one of the questions I've had in my mind is what are they doing now to negate that? What are they doing if they know that there's going to be a gathering and they know that there are potential problems? You know, what is federal law enforcement doing? And have they been told to stop doing what they used to do? Because they, you know, in my experience doing, you know, hate crimes cases, these groups are tracked very closely. Sometimes not, you know, you could understand someone who's a fringe individual, who's a lone wolf, could come out of nowhere. But when you start talking about these sort of organized groups that are posting on social media, that are using sort of public means to get the word out to folks to attend, like, I just sort of wonder what counter moves the government is taking to try to negate this. Because it really is, like, the minute that you let this situation evolve into protesters and counter-protesters who are armed, like, it really is the results are not going to be good in most circumstances. And so I just sort of wonder what you think.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I think that the FBI director, Chris Wray, has talked about these threats, I think, in a reasonable and balanced way. Some of the politicians talk about, you know, one side versus another side and draw distinctions that I'm not sure are right and proper when we're talking about public safety. But, you know, I hope it's true that things are being tracked in the way that they have been in the past, but it's impossible to know.
So one other thing, Preet, I've had in my mind, I just wanted to talk through with you a bit, is that as nationally, there are these conversations about defunding the police, and it means, you and I have talked about this, what that means, no one knows for sure. It means a lot of different things to different people, but there is one very extreme version of it, which is that you'd essentially eliminate law enforcement and that you would have only social service agencies or, you know, community outreach workers on the streets. And it feels to me, you know, I'm deeply against that for many reasons that you and I have talked about. Obviously, I think policing has to be so much better than it is, and we have to stop what's been happening in this biased policing and the killing of unarmed Black men, obviously. But this idea of having no law enforcement presence, it just really came home to me with this idea of if you didn't have the police on the street, you would have people like Rittenhouse and others who are taking it upon themselves to be, quote, protecting the used car lot, to be protecting the buildings. And it just really, you know, it raised this issue for me of, like, where are we going with this? And just making people aware that, defunding the police would necessarily mean that other people take it upon themselves to sort of do public safety. And just, I don't know if you have any thoughts about it, but it's an extreme version of it, obviously, but it just sort of raises with me the importance of the police to provide safety in a community, not to have these sort of homegrown militias thinking that they're the ones who are going to provide private security.
Yeah, I don't think it should be left up to private citizens to take into their own hands either protection in this way, and then what follows after that is, you know, how they hold people accountable. And if that is in the hands of private citizens and young men, not even of the age of 18, like Rittenhouse, that's a recipe for a worse disaster than we're in now. So I agree. So before we go, Anne, something that I've been saying over and over again, the election's coming. In some states, there are still primaries. Vote, register to vote, figure out how to vote, vote early. Don't vote often. That's illegal. And there's a primary actually in the state of Massachusetts today, and it's a highly watched race, one of the ballots. And it's Representative Joe Kennedy, who is challenging the incumbent senator, also a Democrat, Ed Markey, for the Senate seat. And it's unclear who's going to win. I think Markey has a slight advantage. But last week, there was a new development in the race. It turns out that a lot of mail-in ballot voters have not been voting either for Markey or Kennedy, and they've been voting for a write-in candidate whose name is Vermin Supreme. You heard that right. Vermin Supreme. Which used to be my nickname. No, actually not. A noted performance artist known for his wizard-like beard and boot hat, Mr. Supreme, or Vermin, decided to ride the wave of support and officially announced his write-in candidacy for the Massachusetts Senate seat. And we thought people might want to know some of his platform.
Yes. So Vermin has a whole campaign platform that he's put up. He's got four core tenets to his campaign. The first is he wants to reform America's police departments and enact mandatory toothbrushing laws. He believes that America has been suffering a great moral...
Haven't we done that? I thought we had moral. That. At least in this house, we have that.
He writes, America has been suffering a great moral and oral decay in spirit and incisors. Gingivitis has been eroding the gum line of this great nation long enough. And so, and instead of police forces, he wants to replace police officers with moral hygienists.
What does that mean? Oh, it says, yes, I guess in this, the moral hygienists will conduct regular inspections of all individuals seeking out any traces of literal or ethical gingivitis.
But that's not all, Preet. The second part of his platform, that's not all. So the second part of the platform is for Vermin to replace detention centers along the border with like a theme park that he would focus around fun that would have a lazy river around the perimeter. And the lazy river will be known as the border, and it will be patrolled by lifeguards. The third part of his platform involves prison reform, where every inmate will be given a brand new dental hygiene kit. No, there'll be daily group toothbrushing sessions and flossing lessons. And they will also get lifeguard training so they could be lifeguards at the border lazy river. There's one more thing, Preet.
Can I say what the fourth pillar of his platform
Please.
Is? Because it's my favorite one.
Yes.
Number four, universal pony ownership. He says, Vermin says he will give a pony to every American. Quote, we can afford all these wars. We can afford this, that, and the other thing, so why not ponies, end quote.
Why not ponies? Yeah.
I think he's got a shot.
It's a very, very good question.
I think he's got a shot.
I think it's really interesting. Is he a dentist, by the way? I don't know, but there seems to be a strange amount of
Would you go to a dentist named Vermin Supreme?
I would not. Would you?
I don't think I would.
But I don't really like the dentist to begin with. Sorry, dentist.
If I got a pony, I would think about it.
I mean, who doesn't like a pony?
Who doesn't like a pony? Anyway, we will be bringing you updates on these cases that we've discussed, on Vermin Supreme, and anything else that transpires between now and next week. Thanks, Anne.
Thanks, Preet. Talk to you soon.
Send us your questions to letters@cafe.com. That's it for this week's Insider Podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Anne Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The senior audio producer is David Tatasciore. And the Cafe team is Matthew Billy, Nat Wiener, Sam Ozer-Staden, David Kurlander, Noah Azulai, Jake Kaplan, Calvin Lord, Jeff Eisenman, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Margot Malley. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.